Save big during Labor Day at Lowe's. Get up to 40% off select major appliances. Plus, buy more to get up to an additional 20% off. Shop even more savings with 3 Stay Green 1-cubic foot vegetable and flower garden soil bags for $10. This Labor Day, take care of your home for less at Lowe's. We help. You save. Valid through 9/3. Soil offer excludes Alaska and Hawaii. Selection varies by location. Select locations only. While supplies last. See Lowe's.com for more details.
Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Now available on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, PodcastOne.com, and anywhere else you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome. You're tuned into the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Darkness Radio. I'm Dave Schrader. That's Tim Dennis. Hello, Tim.
Hey.
The weeks and months are peeling back, buddy. Can you believe we're getting close to the half-year mark already?
I can't.
I mean, it just feels like it was already March, and here we are coming into June again.
Yeah.
And life as we know it is certainly different than it was a year ago at this time, but thankfully we're here. We're able to continue bringing you the content that we promised we would do. And we've got a great guest returning with us today. Dr. Heather Lynn, PhD, is joining us. We spoke with her about her book, Evil Archaeology, a while back. And so many of you loved it and wanted us to connect with Dr. Lynn again. And it's been some juggling to make sure everybody was healthy, happy, and ready to go. But we finally got Dr. Lynn back. And her new book, The Anunnaki Connection, Sumerian Gods, Alien DNA, and the Fate of Humanity, From Eden to Armageddon, came out on March 1st, 2020. We have a link for that, as a matter of fact, in today's program, so you can find the link and go in there. As a matter of fact, that link will take you in to our Darkness Radio bookshop. It is all of the books that you hear us talk about on this show and on our True Crime Tuesday program. We also have a gift shop area that has all these cool items that I think people are going to be, from clothes to games to, boy, you mentioned it, we've got it in there. There's all kinds of fun knickknacks, coffee mugs and everything paranormal themed, witchy, vampire, ghosts, goblins. You want it, we've got it. Go check out that shop. And yes, many of you have asked in the past, but Dave, if I go in and I buy anything else, will it count? Yes, it does. Once you go in through our portal, anything that you purchase, even if it's not in our stores, a small, very small percentage does go to the Darkness Radio shop. So thank you very much for the love and support in doing that. Dr. Heather Lynn, thank you so much for coming back with us.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I'm glad I could make it on.
Let's, I just want to start with the basics, because we always have new listeners coming in and picking up. I don't want to just assume people understand what an Anunnaki or Sumerian gods or any of this means. So talk to us, if you would, take us through the portal of time 6,000 years ago to the world's first civilization, the Sumerians. What can you tell us that we know about this race and its history?
Wow. Well, it is an amazing story of an almost forgotten civilization in a lot of ways. I tell the story sometimes of, my students. I teach humanities, and I'll ask them, has anybody ever heard of the Sumerians? And a lot of them will say no. Maybe a few will raise their hand, but compared to something like the Egyptians, where most people were familiar, a lot of times the people who are in college right now, unless they've studied this specifically, the high schools, and middle schools and regular public school systems, they don't spend a lot of time teaching about who these people were. And so that's something that I found to be really interesting and strange. And more and more, I think they're being included in the textbooks, but only as sort of a side note, like, isn't that interesting? And so you could just think of them as some, small, insignificant, but kind of interesting group of people from the very ancient past, but that would be completely wrong. It is one of the most, if not the most important civilization, that we know of today. I mean, you're talking about a period you know, 4,000 years ago of people who, you know, between, let's say, 4,000 to 6,000 years ago, in a lot of different ways, the there was the Ubaid period, which came like right before it, that was around 6,500 to 3,800 BCE. And that's about the same time when the ancient Sumerian city-state of Ur was originally settled. You know, and this is when the earth was, you know, it wasn't something crazy like a Jurassic period, but it was still a time where things were very different. I mean, at that time, the Persian Gulf's water level was much higher than it is today. And so the Sumerians, you know, for anyone who doesn't know, they were they inhabited Mesopotamia, and that would be close to and around modern day Iraq. And so, you know, at the time, like I said, the Persian Gulf's water level was higher, and there were changes in the landscape where the climate became warm and wet, and that contributed to the growth of dense forests. And, you know, there was this mountain range that's, you know, obviously still there in present day Iran. And so what you have is this beautiful area of deciduous and, you know, trees and forests. And here come this amazing civilization who seemingly arrive out of nowhere. And this is part of what makes them very interesting and also in a lot of ways controversial. So the Sumerians appeared out of nowhere, so it seems, in the archaeological record. And this is from mainstream scholars. They call this the Sumerian problem. They say, how is it that in this area that was settled by sort of semi-settled hunter-gatherer groups in this Ubaid period, how is it that this other civilization comes in with no known ties to the region, and their language is completely different than anything around it, as though they came from somewhere else and inhabited the region and mobilized the hunter-gatherer groups, changed everything about their way of life, and introduced amazing inventions and technologies, things like astronomy, weights and measures, mathematics, the wheel, wheeled vehicles, even boats, specifically sailboats. They had the concept of a work day where you would work a full day or go to school even for a full day and be done. They had labor unions and professions and even things like pills and advanced medical technologies that, you know, you would not even believe that they had back then. And so, you know, and I, in the book, I list this huge list of all the things that they're credited with either inventing or discovering. And so
now,
these inventions.
Can I ask you really quickly, for most people, this may be the first time they've ever heard of the Sumerians, right?
Yes.
How is it that such an advanced civilization like this, such an advanced race of peoples, has gone and been considered almost fringe science? If I don't know if I'm using that term properly as well, but you know, it almost seems to be right up there with the Lemurians and Atlanteans.
It is quite weird and amazing at the same time. I mean, the discovery of the Sumerians completely shook up the academic world. It rattled all pre-existing beliefs about the rise of human civilizations. You know, who were these people and why were they left out of the archaeological and historical record for over 2,000 years? I mean, again, this isn't even just fringe people asking this. This is a question that the academics themselves had when they first discovered this civilization. They thought, wait a minute, what's going on? And during the time, say the 1920s, roughly, when this started really coming about, where people were finding these sites and translating or trying to translate some of the texts, it was a time where they were really concerned about how this would affect their religious ideals and dogma, because what they would find when they would translate the text would be the basic underlying principles of the Bible stories, mostly from the Old Testament, of course. So what they found were versions of, say, the Noah story, the Great Flood. And just knowing that was enough to say, wait a minute, this changes everything. And so that was one thing that contributed to early on keeping it kind of, you know, keeping a lid on it. But then you have the question of the Sumerian problem, which was discussed in the 1960s by a professor Kramer, Samuel Noah Kramer, who wrote extensively on this. He, you know, talks about this in his work about why the Sumerian language doesn't fit into any major linguistic groups, which has made scholars conclude then, of course, that these people had to have come from somewhere else.
Now, can we stop with that? All right. Mm-hmm. That concept is interesting. And on the overall, the glossary glance at it, that sounds like, ooh, aliens, right? Or, mm-hmm. or heavenly figures that were thrown out that, you know, landed here on Earth, and this is what they brought with them. But
yes,
there are distinct differences in the way people speak, the different areas. Couldn't it just be said that a close, tight-knit group of people created their own civilization, their own language, their own basis just on what they knew, and it didn't necessarily have to come from an outside influence, especially that far back? We're giving a lot of breath to the fact that we're kind of measuring it against the civilizations of today, where every corner of the planet seems to be inhabited and in, you know, major ways. There are now billions more people on the planet than there were then, and the isolation of these groups and their characteristics. Why isn't it that we can't just give them their due, that maybe they were just a group that was enlightened and came about naturally?
Well, I think we can, but the problem with it is just a little bit more technical when it comes to the idea of the people who originally inhabited the region actually coming up with some of these languages and discoveries, based on just the original ideas that Sumerian as a language doesn't fit into any of the major linguistic groups that are from that area. So the groups in Mesopotamia were known to speak Semitic languages, which are the branch of an Afro-Asiatic language group that are traced to the Middle East. And so there's this sort of track record of how the language there evolved and, you know, sort of the roots of it too. Now, something really important is also the lack of written history from the area before the Sumerians. The Sumerians were very much interested in record keeping, and so they really had this language thing down, if you will. The people around there were dabbling in pictographs and, you know, this sort of thing. But the idea that most scholars feel is that the Sumerians came from somewhere else based on that particular component about the Afro-Asiatic language group and the differences there. When they started looking at the tablets that they found that numerous words and syllabic values didn't completely fit with the understanding that they had previously of the Semitic grammar and vocabulary. So they realized that, you know, what they had was something completely different and enigmatic. And that's sort of where it stands now, is still in this idea that it had to have come from somewhere else. So as you mentioned, it could be easy then to take the leap and say, well, then clearly that means they came from way out there, that they're right. Alien beings,
right.
You know, but you know, it's something that I obviously address in the book, because that's the $1 million question. Everybody wants to, you know, find out. But I kind of break it down a lot more into this idea of who the Sumerians were, who specifically the Anunnaki were, because that's a more complicated question in and of itself. And I do point to it being visitors from not necessarily outer space, but from a pre-flood civilization. Some organized okay. band of people that came from a specific area in the north who had high technologies, you know, for the time, and that they survived the flood by migrating south, and that when they came to Mesopotamia, to pretty much have like a breakaway civilization in a lot of ways. And this is based on the ancient texts themselves, what they actually point to. They, came across the people who were semi-settled hunter-gatherers in the area and then forever changed their whole culture, trajectory, and civilization from that point on. Now, that doesn't also exclude ideas and notions of an otherworldly influence, but for that, you have to start looking more deeply as to what the term Anunnaki means and who the Anunnaki could be and who were the actual visitors and people, the human beings that came and settled in the region of Mesopotamia that long ago, changing the culture forever and building these monuments and buildings and structures of civilization. And so I think part of it really does have to do with the speed at which this was accomplished. And this is, you know, all of this happened from about, 200 to 300 years. In that span, you would go in that area from having, you know, nothing other than some pottery and you know, a little bit of not really agriculture, but gathering, you know, harvesting wild grains, this sort of thing, to having astronomy and having a whole civilization, all the cornerstones that academics generally term high civilization. You know, there's a lot of the criteria for what it means to have high civilization and a high culture. And nobody had that before the Sumerians. And that would include things like a large urban center, full-time specialist occupations, monumental architecture, ruling classes who didn't do manual labor, class structure, state religion, so many different things. But there's a full list that is generally accepted, the idea that, you know, these hunter-gatherers didn't have that. And, you know, you could say, well, there's sites like Göbekli Tepe that show possible evidence of these sorts of things, like having a large center, at least, and, you know, an ideology and a religion and all of these different things that we can, you know, guess or speculate. But what it lacks is, you know, all of these different things, that there were places like Göbekli Tepe or even Stonehenge that have been used as massive ritualistic meeting places, but they are not truly considered permanent settlements or urban centers. And so in both places, there have not been traces of domesticated plants or animals found, at least not yet. I mean, it would take many years to excavate fully Göbekli Tepe. So, I mean, we very well could see that change, but it is kind of an important aspect to it that, you know, there's these hunter-gatherer societies were very advanced, but they were missing the key attributes of what scholars define as civilization. And so that really is what distinguishes the people that were there before with the Sumerians and why it matters and why maybe it's not as easy to say, well, maybe that it just evolved organically is just this question of how did it happen so fast? And obviously 200, 300 years or so isn't that fast, but when you look at it in the broad scheme of things, that's pretty fast. And so that's what's, I guess, baffled most researchers, both mainstream and fringe, for so long and created the mystique around the Sumerians and, of course, their gods, the Anunnaki.
All right. Now, in examining these stories, going back, I mean, this is something that's so far back, Dr. Lin, and so speculative, it seems, and up for interpretation. How do we put a defining kind of thumbprint or, you know, mark on this, that this is what we do certainly know, this is what we can tell, and this is where the conjecture comes in?
That is probably a really hard thing to answer for one. Maybe some would disagree. They would say, well, you know, look at the evidence. We have these tablets. This is what we can believe. This is, you know, what's real. However, it does leave a lot open for speculation because there are many tablets that are not translated. There are many tablets that have been translated, but translation alone doesn't really cut it. I mean, what we're looking at now is interpretation questions. I think that's really where things get tricky. Because you could say, I use the example of the word cool. If I say, you know, that your your car is really cool. You'll know what I mean, most likely. And 50 years ago, you would have likely understood what I meant. And arguably, you know, at least 10 years from now, you'll know what I mean as well. And you'll know that it has something to do not with a temperature, but with some sort of status or you know, perception of status. But if I were to just translate the word cool, I would say, well, it has to do with something being, you know, lower in temperature, sort of a, you know, whatever. And so what we'd be missing is completely the context and a lot of different things around it, the understanding of the culture and what they meant and, you know, simple things like slang even. That's an easy example, but that's just one way of looking at it. So really, you can translate something all day, but the interpretation is where, I guess, the magic kicks in. And that's probably the problem, because that's the qualitative analysis as opposed to even the quantitative. At this point, it is left for interpretation. And so what you want to try to do is make sure that the person who's interpreting it has a you know, range of knowledge and understanding of the cultures and this sort of thing. But again, we're talking about a civilization that's thousands of years old. So it's really difficult to do that. So it's left a vacuum. It's left a vacuum in the understanding that has been filled by anything and everything. And it's hard to argue against those things because they're interpretations. So, you know, the only thing you could do is say, well, it doesn't say that in the text. Well, no, but it says weird things that you could, like, you know, take out of context or add your own interpretation to. And, you know, then you could say, well, I'm going to look at it literally. Well, fine. That's a good way to do it, I suppose. But then not, because it's sort of like a biblical style language where they were very poetic. They wrote in epic poetry. And so if they talk about a giant bull coming from the sky and, you know, killing everybody, are you going to take that literally too? And so where does this go? And so I think that's added to, in a way, the maybe frenzy in some way of trying to interpret these things. So, yes, you can look at the language. There are people who can read this. This is another misnomer that the texts are so esoteric that nobody can interpret them. And that's just simply not the case. And it hasn't been the case because, you know, on my desk right now, I'm looking at, you know, a book that is very old of Sumerian records from 1966. Well, I guess it's not very old. It just looks old. But yes,
hold your roll there.
No, it's 1914. It's a reprint. This is 1914. So 1914, they were, translating some of this. And of course, they were translating Babylonian and Akkadian, which are very similar. And Sumerian is very close to Hebrew. And so there's a lot of ways that people can kind of cross-reference and understand these languages. And they have for a long time. And so you do get the people who say, yeah, but Zechariah Sitchin, for instance, he was the only person who came out and was able to really understand that. And I'll say he spent a lot of time researching and he did a lot of interesting work and he did have a background, you know, in Hebrew, but he was not the only person and nor is he the only person to work on this. And there's many people, even in mainstream academia, that this is what they do. Not a lot, not as much as, say, you know, business majors or something, you know, more practical, if you will, but there are still people doing this and the information is available online and in books. And so you can, you know, look at this and it's not really hidden. It's just not promoted and not easily accessible. That's probably the biggest problem, is that as most academic things go, you either have to have memberships to, you know, ProQuest or a lot of the databases, or be affiliated somehow to easily access and freely access a lot of the information. And then there's just the case of a lot of the tablets have not been translated because they just don't have the people to do it. There's not people with the interest, or it's a low priority for the museum. And then there's ones that have been sold on the black market. And so we'll not have those. You know, there's so many factors into this that it leaves this huge space that can be inhabited then by conspiracies and all sorts of different things. And that's not to say there's nothing, you know, shady going on. It's just to say that it naturally breeds that sort of, you know, speculative environment. And, you know, it can leave people more confused than informed.
It seems even in mainstream history, and science. There's a lot of combative nature regarding the truth of a situation. Is there a lot of infighting in this type of research as well? A lot of a lot of people butting heads on what these interpretations mean.
I think that is exactly what's going on. I think for the most part, in the mainstream view of things, there is always going to be butting heads because people are looking out for their career. They're looking out for their reputation. And then because it is so closely related to biblical research and language and the time period and that sort of thing, there is a lot of biblical aspects to it that can make the researchers more biased than others. So for instance, you'll have people who, you know, they study the Bible and they're trying to look at these things and then they relate it to biblical studies. And then so that level of bias will, you know, invariably lead to more passionate butting of heads in a mainstream sort of situation. And so you do have that going on in the mainstream. But what I found, maybe sadly, and it's something that kind of spurred me to write the book, was the more I looked into it from like a fringe perspective, the more I found that in this alternative research field, that was going on almost worse than in mainstream, that this butting of heads. And I thought, well, isn't this counterproductive, obviously? And it's also counter to the spirit of what it means to be an alternative researcher. For me, something that's always been a draw in alternative research is this idea of camaraderie and community, where most people, in my experience, if you say believe in something that I don't, maybe you're talking about, you know, you believe that there's a colony of Bigfoots living on Mars, and we're going to like learn about that pretty soon through like Disclosure.
Right. I mean, we all know that, Dr. Lee.
Oh, like, obviously. So it's like, fine, okay, I may not really be interested in exploring that, but guess what? What I think is also going to sound pretty out there to other people. And so because there's so few of us going in all these different directions, and we're all supposed to be promoting a freedom of speech and thought and a creativity and all of this community, it used to feel more inclusive that you had your views, I had my views, we would share those together, and it was fine. But what I found more recently, and particularly with the subject of the Sumerians, is this is not the case. It's become very polarized to you're either for everything Sitchin has said or you are not. And that's where the line is drawn. And people are very passionate, very angry sometimes. I mean, I've been the recipient of these emails. And when I even had an email recently from somebody who was quite nice, but they were truly genuinely wanting to know about my book. They said, so which you know, position do you take? Do you take the, we as humans were enslaved by the Anunnaki to mine gold, or were we enslaved by the Anunnaki to, you know, have agriculture, as though there's only those two things? And so that's something that, you know, I started to come across the more and more I looked, and the more online I would, you know, research things, I wouldn't find references to a lot of the pre-existing tablets, or, you know, there wasn't a lot of these dots connected. It was more so just regurgitation and support for, you know, different prominent authors in the field. And then this sort of cult of personality where it was like, well, if you don't believe it, then psh, you're wrong. What struck me too is that's not how I believe any of these alternative researchers would or would have felt if they were alive now. So for instance, Sitchin, I don't believe for a minute, you know, Sitchin would be opposed to somebody asking him about his ideas or challenging his ideas. I think he welcomed that and welcomed the opportunity then to, you know, support his own ideas and have this discussion. But right, the idea
that's how we make the biggest leaps in
exactly.
our civilization is we break things down, we make a theory out of it, we make an example out of it, and then we open it up for debates. That's how it's done every day. There's peer-reviewed papers. People have a chance to look over, review, break down the problems, and you do that because you want an outside glance. Sometimes we do get too close to a situation, and you know, Sitchin was not above being human and fallible.
Exactly. That's my point exactly. And so whenever I've gone to say, well, you know, I didn't agree with him on this point or that point. I've been told, oh, what? Wait, oh, well then fine. Like, end of discussion. And it's like, no. That's supposed to be the beginning of the discussion. And that doesn't mean that I'm saying that Sitchin was just completely useless. I think it's absolutely wrong. I'm a firm believer that alternative theories and diverse interpretations are just so vital to discourse and debate. But more and more, you know, empirical research, even just in this fringe, you know, side of things, is leaning on this Cartesian style reductionism, which just, it doesn't count this idea of some sort of complex system existing, but that this whatever complexity out there can just simply be explained by saying, okay, we're just going to cut it down to its most basic thing. Boom, that's the answer. Done. And if you disagree, then you're disinformation, or, you know, there's all these negative things. And I'm like, what's happened? You know, this is not, you know, how we should be conducting ourselves
That's the way it's been for all time. Everybody stands for their position, what they believe in, and will battle it even when they're proven incorrect most times.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. And so it's kind of, you know, trickled on down to, well, you know, it does that. Like you said, it's probably something that'll never go away, but it just feels like it's important right now in this time of division to kind of put out a book like Anunnaki Connection, where I'm connecting some of the ideas, as opposed to going out there saying, you know, this book's all about debunking, or this book is just another, like, you know, love fest for your favorite author. It's neither of those things. It's just my own views and my own attempts to understand this and contextualize it. And, you know, that's made some people very angry because they don't come out of it with what they were hoping, which was, you know, sort of justification for their own pre-existing beliefs. But I have to say, I've had other people who were very happy, because a lot of people are looking for maybe just a new way of looking at these issues, as opposed to just having to be forced to one side or the other.
Podcast One presents. This is a collect call from Sing Sing.
My name is John J. Lennon. I'm locked up for selling drugs and committing murder. I'm also a contributor for Esquire magazine and the Marshall Project. So I'm a writer and I'm a prisoner. Imagine trying to stay focused and talk about issues of substance with geeks slamming, prisoners screaming, and PAs blaring in the background.
Get new episodes every Wednesday on Spotify, Podcast One, and Apple Podcasts.
You can read it for yourself, judge for yourself, The Anunnaki Connection, Sumerian Gods, Alien DNA, and the Fate of Humanity. That's the name of the book. The link, again, is up on today's program, so it's easy to find and take with you. And again, challenge yourself. Whatever you think you know or don't know about this topic, examine it and look at the different aspects that Dr. Heather Lynn provides in this book. So we've talked about some of the Sumerian culture, the ratios of what they might have been, who they might have been, these concepts. Now, there's still the mystery kind of revolving around them. So what do we believe are the most logical jumps of who the Sumerians are and where they came from?
Well, I think there's still a lot of ways to answer that, because we just simply don't know. But from what I sort of put together, I guess, in my own research, is a little complicated, but also maybe a little simplistic at the same time. So, you know, we can never know the answers to any of these, maybe. I mean, maybe we could, but I doubt it. But I think over time in the Near East, what happened, as I mentioned before in the show, there was an almost extinction event that led a group of people who were displaced scholars and scientists to leave and resettle somewhere else. And that sounds very basic, but as I said in the book, I kind of go over which tablets say this, and it really has a lot to do with the Noah story, because the Noah story predates, you know, when the Old Testament was written and what it said about this. And it was like something that happened way earlier. And the Noah story now is something, if you say, okay, what happened with Noah's Ark? You've pictured like two giraffes and two, you know, usually drawn like male lions, you know, because they're prettier, going up into this ark. And it's just this whole kind of mythos and symbolism we see. But if you really look at the original tablets of that story, it talks more about the individuals and what their position was, not as biological family members to the Noah figure, but rather important members of society, the learned scholars, the technocrats, the leaders who understood, you know, astronomy. One of them would be the bearer of knowledge of agriculture and so on. So they picked the best of the best to intentionally go create a breakaway society. They also, rather than say, well, we're going to put two of each kind of animal all over the world and this sort of thing, what the text actually says is that these people took the animals of the steppe with them. And when you really dig into that and understand how things were communicated then, it really does point more closely to the idea that the animals of the steppe were considered things that they would use to live on. If you're a nomadic, you would take your, you know, your goats, you would take your animals with you so that you could survive. It wouldn't be one of, you know, two of every animal that ever existed and was ever conceptualized. It would have been your domesticated animals because you need them to survive. So this was, it was like an old bug out bag in a lot of ways, like grab the animals, grab the experts. We're getting out of here because nobody believes our astronomers and our, you know, meteorologists in the sense that this is going to happen, that there's something that's going to happen to devastate this society. And so they took off, they ran, they left. And this is really what you start to see emerge when you look at a lot of the tablets. And then later it becomes, you know, a different story and different interpretations and things get, you know, changed a little bit. But so if you really consider that, these people, when they would have gotten to Mesopotamia that was already inhabited by these hunter-gatherer people, there would have been a really big clash of cultures. And I mean, to say that, I mean, that would be an understatement, really. But when you look at the ancient texts and what they say, they refer to the people who were living there, the regular people, as the black-headed people. That's something really important. You see this echoed throughout all the Sumerian texts, the black-headed people, the black-headed people. And so, you know, it stands to reason that if you also had black hair, why would you differentiate those people from you by calling out a trait that you have as well? It would seem to be more likely that they did not have black hair. So they look different. They had a different genetic background. Also, they referred to these people as the Adama. And you know, the Adama is where we get the word or the name Adam. And so Adama meant the red people. And how that's usually taken is a commentary on how man was made from clay. So he was brought up from clay and then he's called the red people. And that's sort of a Hebrew or religious even way of thinking about it. But, you know, there's another way to look at it, in my opinion, that there was a specific type of ochre that was available in the region that archaeologists have found used to decorate the skulls and the remains of the people there before the Sumerian culture. And they use that in sort of like an adorning fashion. And it was a very specific type of red. And so, you know, it could be, and again, this is speculative, but I do offer a lot of resources to kind of like follow this up and check it out. But it could be too that these people looked red. Upon arrival, they may have had black hair and they had painted themselves red, you know, in a tribal kind of way. And so here you have these people coming from afar and they're describing what they're seeing. They were also considered much shorter because the people, based on the archaeological evidence, they were shorter. They were less than 5 foot tall. That stands to reason because if they were hunter-gatherers, they often didn't have, you know, an adequate protein supply on a regular and consistent basis. However, the people that may have come from elsewhere could have been, given that they had domesticated animals and that was something very important to them, they could have had a much bigger stature. Even if they were 6 foot tall compared to someone who was, you know, 4'10", that would look quite big. And so that could lead you to say, well, these were giants, you know. And so here you start seeing a pattern of what people generally and how they describe the Anunnaki. And, you know, more is interesting. There's this story that comes about where we actually get descriptions of what they like to eat, which is kind of strange. But for people who start to say, well, they were not real, or, you know, they were kind of like aliens, or what have you. Well, they are described in a very human-like way, meaning that they were biological entities. And so there's all of this different, you know, discussion. There's recipe books. It's really bizarre, but they had a huge emphasis on food, and not just any food, but burnt offerings and specific types of meats. Whereas the people who were living there before were mostly plant-based. They were gathering a lot more. They were eating a lot of grains, and they could hunt, but it just wasn't the same environment. And here we have a story in the text that discuss how, you know, these beings came down to them and demanded that they worship them by burning meat. You know, the word worship meant to work for. And so what you would do is you'd go and cultivate or work to get these animals, and then you were told you had to go burn them. And, you know, that's like where we get this idea of these burnt offerings. But the texts go on to explain that they weren't just burned and there wasn't just a magic word said. It was actually a huge barbecue. And there were specific animals that they wanted to eat. And I guess when the Anunnaki first came, they tried to eat like the locals, but they were not happy about it. They could never be satisfied until they had meat. And you just see this really crazy sort of, you know, clash of cultures happening. And you have a social class that is divided. And then you have the story of how, you know, they were not supposed to mingle with these lesser beings until after a while, you know, they one would break away and do that sort of thing, kind of like the Prometheus figure, or what, you know, they described as Enki. And so you get this whole story that really, to me, when you look at it, appears to be the story of, you know, humans coming in who had great knowledge of things, and they came and exploited the people who were already there, but then eventually assimilated. But again, that doesn't always explain some of the earlier texts about the Anunnaki as sages. So it's the Anunnaki, and this is going to sound really out there, but the Anunnaki, the people or the beings like the Enki or the An or whomever that people generally think of as the Anunnaki, they themselves had Anunnaki. So they themselves had a separate pantheon. And that's where things get a little bit strange. Though that separate pantheon that we still kind of throw under the title of Anunnaki, they were described very differently, that they weren't physical, that they were either ghosts or that they were semi-biological beings, and that they were the ones that taught the initial Anunnaki, the leaders, all of these high technologies. And they were the ones that taught them that they needed to burn living beings as the offerings. And so I think what we're looking at is, you know, multiple stories wrapped up into one, which makes it all the more difficult to sort of piece it together without any, you know, uncertainty and say, well, clearly they came from this place and did this and flew off on their spaceship and that was the end of that. So
the Anunnaki connection, we've got more to talk about. Our guest, Dr. Heather Lynn, will be back. You're listening to the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Darkness Radio.
On a scale of 1 to 10 this week, how was your pain level? How was your anxiety level? Did you get through the week okay? I know times are tough right now. We've all been going through, you know, that virus thing and the stress from that. And I know the weather's changing. Spring is here, and I gotta tell you, pain levels are off the charts, and it's not been fun. It's your buddy Tim for Feels. I tell you, I've been taking my Feels, my CBD, and it's been helping me. I've been getting through these tough times, both anxiety and stress-wise, and pain-wise, it's been helping. You know, I've been getting more and more of you who've been reaching out to me and saying to me, hey, Tim, is that for real? You're just saying that? Is this just words? No, it's not just words. It's just not something I say. I don't just get on here and flap my gums at you. Feels really does help me feel better. I'm not putting one over on you. Feels is amazing. I've been using Feels now for weeks. And it's been helping me with my pain. It's amazing. It's been helping me with my sleep. I'm telling you, before I got Feels, I was sleeping maybe an hour at a time. I'd get up in an immense pain in my neck and my back and my knees. And it was aching so much that, and I know you're feeling this as I'm telling you this, that I would get up and I'd sit on the side of my bed and I'd rock back and forth and I couldn't take it anymore. And then I found Feels. I take a full dropper of Feels, put it under my tongue for 30 seconds. And within just a few minutes, that pain subsides and I'm ready to go back to bed. I get that same thing during the day when I'm taping this show. Sometimes Dave and I will tape a couple of shows in a row and I can really only tolerate sitting in a chair for about an hour, hour and a half. And there's days where I'm sitting here 8-9 hours and man, you want to talk about pain, but you know what helps me with that pain? Feels. Feels helps me with that pain. And I get through it. Again, it's a dropper. I take a full dropper's full and put it under my tongue for 30 seconds and I start to feel that pain wash away. Now, you may be saying to yourself, if this is the first time you've heard me talk about Feels, Tim, what is Feels? Well, Feels is premium CBD delivered directly to your doorstep. It's naturally helping me reduce my stress, my anxiety, my pain, and sleeplessness. And Feels is premium CBD. You may be new to the realm of CBD, and that's okay. You know, you may have questions about CBD, and that's fine. The people at Feels are ready to be there for you to answer your questions. How do you take CBD and Feels? Well, it's easy. It comes in a liquid form and you place a few drops of Feels under your tongue and you feel the difference within minutes. The thing to remember about CBD is that finding the right dose is important. And thank God I've had a lot of you who have reached out to me in the last few weeks and asked, you know, how much do you take? I'm a little different. I'm used to taking it. I've taken a lot of different opioids and different pain medications over the years, and I've got a high tolerance, so I take a lot more. You may not need as much. You may only need a few drops. Everybody's dose is different. So leave room to experiment over the course of a week or so, and you may need to take more or less, just depending, to get the effects that you're looking for. But what's nice about Feels is if you're new to CBD, Feels will offer a free CBD hotline, and they do to help you guide you through your personal experience if you have those questions. You can feel better naturally, folks, through Feels, and I feel better naturally through Feels, and I encourage you to contact Feels and try it. Try it. It works naturally to help you feel better. There's no high, no hangover, no addiction. It just helps you feel better naturally. You just feel that pain wash away and you just start to feel better. You owe it to yourself. And you know, you do sometimes get that anxiety from being in so much pain. You know what I'm talking about? You get that crippling anxiety that you're going to start to feel more pain once it starts to subside. You're getting ready for that next wave. Even people who just have anxiety, not even chronic pain, but just anxiety, CBD works for that as well. You're going to want to try Feels. You can join the Feels community to get Feels delivered to your door every month. You'll save money on every order and you can pause or cancel at any time. Although I don't know why you'd want to. I say this every week. I don't know why you'd want to once you try Feels. Now, Feels has me feeling my best every day. It can help you too. I stress this to you every week. Become a member today by going to Feels, that's F-E-A-L-S, feels.com/darkness. You're going to get 50% off your first order with free shipping. That's feels.com, feals.com/darkness to become a member and get 50% automatically taken off your first order with free shipping. Do yourself a favor this week. I know you've heard my voice plenty in the last few weeks, and you've been thinking about it. You've been thinking real hard about it. You know, can I afford it? Can I do it? Can you afford not to do it? Can you afford to be in pain one more week? Can you afford to have that anxiety one more week? Can you afford another sleepless night this week? You know what? You're not alone. There's a lot of us out there who suffer with pain, suffer with anxiety. The weight of the world is on a lot of our shoulders right now. And you don't need the extra pain. You don't need the extra anxiety. You don't need the extra stress that comes with all of that. Feels can help you right now, naturally. Go ahead, give it a try. Feels, feals.com/darkness. Get 50% off your first order with free shipping. One more time, feels.com darkness. Take advantage of it today.
Alien intervention, humanity in the clutches of visitors from another place, burnt offerings. Obviously, this is probably what makes most people stand back and scratch their head and think this sounds all too fantastic to believe that this could be a legitimate part of our history. Dr. Lin, you look over this. It's speculative at best, right? But I mean, to hear the fantastical aspects, do you understand why people are more reticent to just buy into these concepts and beliefs, and why this part of history might be more easily pushed underneath the carpet?
Absolutely. I think it opens up too many Pandora's boxes for both, you know, religions, history books that, you know, people don't want to have to rewrite. You know, there's so many things.
So what it comes down to is we're just too damn lazy as a people to rewrite history.
Well, maybe the laziness, but also the pride, because to rewrite the history is to have to go in and admit, you know, that you maybe were wrong, or that you built a lifetime of research on a very faulty foundation. And so, yeah, it's really interesting. You have the so-called debunkers that, you know, also come from an Orthodox religious background or a political or philosophical ideology out there trying to debunk it. You have mainstream media who's actually mocking this great mystery in a lot of ways, with, you know, certain television shows that might make a mockery of it. And you have old guard academics who just simply ignore it and just think, well, whatever. And, you know, I think what makes it worse is what I said in the beginning, is a lot of the public school systems just don't even bother to teach about Sumerians and ancient history in general. And so,
hell, you know, Mike, you know, having been involved in watching them homeschool here and going over history, they don't even really they do a cursory glance at American history at best.
Yes.
It's like the only things that matter in our country right now is the American Revolutionary War, briefly touching on the Civil War, the assassination of Kennedy, assassination of Lincoln, and World War I and World War II. And it's like any other history outside that bubble doesn't exist.
Yeah.
Or it is. It's not worth mentioning, which is so bizarre.
Yeah. Oh, no, it's really bizarre. And I think that, you know, it's a shame. And again, it's left this gap of information that, you know, leads people down a lot of different roads. And I mean, that's not to say that I have all the answers, or that I don't even also hold some probably alternative, you know, to be kind, ways of looking at things that are obviously based in speculation, because most of this cannot be proven. And that's something so important, that even when you see mainstream, you know, academics or people coming out like, oh, I will prove to you that this is wrong and that's wrong, they can't really. They can only give their educated assessment and analysis. And while, you know, and then it comes down to the question of value. Well, whose opinion do you value? Or you just, you know, they have this degree in that or that degree in that. And that's fine. We should value professionals. However, you know, it's still qualitative analysis. It's all of history. And this is something that kind of irritates me about archaeology in general as a discipline. It's that it is not a science. As much as people want to say it's a science, it's not a hard science or a pure science. It's a soft science at best. It's a social science that came out of a discipline that was not even a discipline, but a rich man's hobby called antiquarianism. And so rich men,
Does it follow, and I don't mean to interrupt, but does it fall kind of in the pattern of a theoretical science? Because just by looking at the positioning of bones, the clay pottery, and the rudimentary tools, we're basing an entire idea and culture on very little evidence of what we're actually seeing, right?
Yeah, I would say, you know, there are people that dabble in, you know, theoretical anthropology and those sorts of things. There's sort of an anthropology of everything for everyone. But I would say they're you could look at it that way, especially with a lot of the interesting AI and different tools that are being used to sort of piece pottery together or identify the pottery in general. But I think for the most part, what it is it really just comes down to it's a social science. And in a social science discipline, you use qualitative analysis. And you can use quantitative, I mean, that's an aspect, but that's mixed methods. And so I know it gets a little like shop talk, but it's really important because what it means is that you find the data, you find the, say, pots or the, you know, even the DNA, you get that as your scientific information, but then what? If there's no context, then what? Who's responsible for the context? Well, then it's the person who's interpreting this. It's about interpretation. It's about filling in the blanks and making these stories. It's history, which is basically narrative forming with a little bit of science mixed in. The thing is, archaeology looks like a science because, especially in recent years, they use scientific tools and models and methods, but it is not a science. So you may go out there with ground penetrating radar, which is, you know, a scientific tool. It's very, you know, cool, and it gives you quantitative measurements and boom. Okay, great. But it's not, the whole discipline isn't a science. You just use the scientific tool. What happens when you get that information? Well, you still have to then have a human being sit here and, you know, put it into context and, you know, pontificate about it and do research. And that's not to devalue it at all, because I believe that is valuable. And that's, you know, I have my doctorate in social science. I believe that it's completely valuable. But it's dishonest to present it as a hard science like a chemistry or a biology, because it's not, which means that, you know, you have to kind of go out on a limb sometimes. How far out on a limb? Well, I mean, maybe that's the better question. But if you can support it, who cares? You know, you're allowed to be creative and have these thoughts. At least you should be. And you should be able to have these discussions, and, you know, it should be very interesting. But, you know, a lot of people don't want to have any of that at all, because they are looking to, I don't know. I think it's a little elitist, to be honest. That's my view of it. I think it's a closed door kind of thing, and they don't want to let you in. And I mean, I've been referred to as going to the dark side simply for writing about these things. And so that's sort of how you look at it is, okay, well, because I'm writing about these things, I'm on the dark side. But then nobody takes a moment to actually read what I'm saying, because they just want to judge it from the very beginning. And it's like, well, that's, you know, where we're at. So, yeah, it's a weird field, and they feel very threatened, and they know they're being threatened, because so many people love archaeology, but they don't like that. They don't like that because they don't like the version of archaeology that people are interested in.
Right.
And I think that's kind of strange and too bad. I think if they really want to attract people to hearing what they have to say, they need to get out there and do, you know, public outreach and engage people and do things and be exciting and share their information. But I guess that is also, you know, pointing to their laziness.
Well, let's, you know, in discussing the Anunnaki, do you believe that the Anunnaki are what most people look at as the ancient small g gods?
Yeah, well, I do. I think that they were the prototype for, you know, a lot of different gods, the Greek gods and everything, really. You can see their influence, you know, going all throughout civilization because of, you know, religious syncretism. So, you know, you would go in and have this particular god. And I mean, a good example would be, you know, when you have Poseidon and, you know, he turns into Neptune or what have you. So you have this kind of Greek god, Roman god. I mean, this pattern is pretty well known, but it goes all the way back. So you have all these different, well, so Ishtar could also then have been Venus. And so, I mean, we're talking really far back. They're kind of like the prototype for all these other small g gods. But what is, I think, really a stranger thing to consider is not necessarily the honor, well, let me just say, the Anunnaki, most people are familiar with maybe about 12 of them, give or take some. But there's actually so many they don't even know. There's like they don't know. There could be thousands. So that really makes the question of the word Anunnaki I think that makes it questionable in general. The more I looked into this, the more I saw some really interesting uses of the word Anunnaki in relation to the Sumerian kings lists. There are very old versions of the kings lists that have with it the name of a king, and next to it would be, and he was advised by this sage, and it would give a name. And now in this context, the sages were these otherworldly beings that the Anunnaki believed gave them the messages that they would use to then control the people. And you see this then happen over time, but then as the list goes on through generations, it starts to, you know, kind of drop the whole sage thing, and it turns into that the king himself was the Anunnaki. And so from looking at this and comparing it to some other stories and texts, I believe that what happened is the word Anunnaki meant something specific at first, but then was generalized over time, which helps to make it even more confusing. So like the word Lord, if we say the Lord God, it's like one God, but you could also say landlord or Lord of the Manor. It becomes not only a title, but just a position that you hold. So I believe that's what happened to the Anunnaki, is that it did refer to the set of visitors that came from, you know, an antediluvian place and spread their knowledge. But over time, I think that became a position that they held, and that when they assimilated within to the other populations, that human beings, flesh and blood human beings, would assume the position of the Anunnaki. And which is a whole separate thing from the sages, even though the sages now are considered to be more Anunnaki. But they're very different, and they're portrayed in the art and the texts very differently. The Anunnaki are portrayed as sometimes these animal-human hybrid beings. Sometimes they're portrayed as just simply people with, you know, elaborate headdresses or outfits. And then you see these particular sages, and they are as dots. And dots on the tablets are usually pointing to stars. So they're very closely related to the Pleiadian star system. And they're sort of depicted that way too. Yet, we are now calling them Anunnaki. They also had a holy trinity of Anunnaki that was very much like the holy trinity we would consider now, with a God the Father and a Son and a Holy Ghost. And that was a separate kind of, you know, belief set that was mixed up with this, but now we also call those Anunnaki. So I think part of what makes a lot of people confused about the whole thing is the term Anunnaki itself. And when you can throw all these beings into one pot and say, well, they couldn't be human because they're described as ghosts. Well, they couldn't be ghosts because they were described as, you know, a sort of like alien beings. Well, no, they were described as fish people and so on and so forth. Well, I think it's all of the above.
Right. It's been a catch-all.
Yeah.
For the different variations of things that people cannot explain. You know, it's funny because we've referenced that before. You know, when Jeff Corwin did his examination of the quote unquote Yeti, he found that Yeti was a catch-all phrase for things they just could not understand. He would show them pictures of snow leopards. They had no idea what a snow leopard was. It was a Yeti. They would show pictures of this or that or the other, and it was, oh, yeah, that's the Yeti. So Yeti became this kind of overterm that took on. So that's what it sounds like the Anunnaki really truly was. It was a title that was to something totally different, and then because of its high standing, people just absorbed it into their lexicon of conversation, right? And understanding of hierarchy.
I think so too, because it does seem to be the case in the tablets themselves over a long period of time. It evolves into that. But then I also think that that's just at the fault of the researchers overall, who, you know, just kind of say, well, they're Anunnaki. And when I see, I think a lot of the researchers who do this are actually the alternative researchers who kind of throw them all together and do this. But, you know, when you really get in and unravel it all, it paints a different picture with a lot of different avenues to follow that I actually think are more fascinating than just the ideas of, you know, one mega race of you know, these beings that came in and just, you know, planted their flag down and said, we're changing it all up. And then they enslaved us. And then that's it. I think there's more, way more to it that makes it something valuable to study. And I would hope that more people get inspired to study this, because as I said in the book, Sitchin's work, he did so much to bring this sort of, you know, work and idea and culture to the discussion. And I think the problem, though, really is that what he did was so long ago, and people sometimes forget that it was a while ago, that he did it, he put it out there, and then people just cycled through that. It was almost as though the progress was stunted, and that research into the Anunnaki has just been in this state of suspended animation, where everybody, instead of looking for more and going in there and looking at the research, instead they just kind of go back and cite Sitchin. And as a result, as we get further and further away from when that actual research was done, you know, that's just going to create a much bigger gap, and, you know, the realization of a lot more mistakes that will just discredit him further, instead of saying, let's build on it. Because you better believe that, you know, Isaac Newton was a flake and a half. I mean, he looked at crazy things, and a lot of the things he, you know, did were just absolutely wrong. But it doesn't matter. You know, we don't like harp on that. We look at what he did do that was right. And that's only because we've been able to look back and build, and not just, you know, sort of have it stuck and then look back on there and say, well, that was what some guy did a long time. We have to build on this knowledge.
That's what Tim and I are hoping. History will remember us only for the good things that we did as well.
So, well, that's what we all want, right?
Right. Well, that's why it's called his story, right? I mean, it's the story that we want perpetrated or perpetuated.
Yeah.
All right. So now let's examine the obviously a big part of the title, alien DNA. If these beings, these higher intelligent beings, were from somewhere else, is there any kind of evolutionary proof of that, that we can actually follow down any lineage?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the popular idea is that they created man. And I think that the idea that they created man is not actually too far off, but I don't think that it was in a biological sense. I think that although you can, you know, argue about different ideas of how Earth was seeded and go into all those different discussions, which, you know, I do cover in the book, I think that in the most likely chain of events, the idea of creating man was more about creating our version of man. So in a lot of ways, the civilizing of man. And so I think that in terms of the DNA, this idea of being able to look at this, you know, in a scientific way, I think we're getting closer to that, but I don't, it might be disappointing for, you know, some people who would like to think that it's going to show some sort of really out there sort of, you know, results. But I do think that if you look at something very basic, like the description, as I mentioned before, about black-headed people versus not, if you have the descriptions of these beings having blue eyes, that was something, you know, really important in the descripting kind of, well, not just the descriptions, but also the depictions of the gods, that they had these big blue eyes that they would often use lapis lazuli or, you know, different things to make them look just big and blue. And that became a, like the idea of where we get the evil eye today, because the idea that somebody with a blue eye, you wouldn't want to look in their eye because they could curse you, or it was frightening, that it was something really strange, so much so that now even in the Middle East in souvenir shops, you can get blue colored glass amulets that are shaped sort of like a droplet or an eye, and they're made to wear, or you can hang them up in your car, and it's supposed to, you know, keep the evil eye away. But the evil eye was considered to be you know, blue. And so in the area of Mesopotamia where all this was, the region that's now Iraq, people with blue eyes can certainly be found. But it is not a common trait, and it wasn't a common trait back then. And so it's something that, you know, just gave them this reputation of being different and possibly spooky or evil. But the archaeological Reports suggest that blue-eyed genes originated near the Black Sea, you know, not too far away, due to a genetic mutation that occurred about 6,000 and 10,000 years ago, which would put it, you know, close to the time of the supposed almost extinction event. And so according to, you know, one professor from the University of Copenhagen, all people originally had, I think his name was Iberg. You'll have to forgive me. I have it in the book, but it's Iberg. But all people had brown eyes. But this particular mutation occurred in one individual that affected a gene called the OCA2. And what it did was it turned off the ability to produce brown eyes. And so in cross sections of specimens that he and his team looked at in, I think, 2008, this mutation was seen at exactly the same spot in the DNA, which would indicate that all blue-eyed individuals are linked to one common ancestor that came from that region and then migrated, which is kind of interesting. And so now the geneticists, and this is pretty recent, recently the geneticists believe that blue eyes originated from the Near East area or a northwest part of the Black Sea region where the great agricultural migration of the northern part of Europe took place in the Neolithic periods about 10,000 years ago. And perhaps in the northern part of Afghanistan, I mean, that's where they're speculating it could be. But that's something that, you know, the time frame fits really well, that we could then be able to trace that in terms of how people migrated. And, you know, I don't think it's a stretch, and this is the new research that's out on that. And, of course, it's only one study that they did, but there's been a lot of research in the you know, literature about the origin of the blue eyes. And it's hard to discuss in a lot of ways because you start to get a lot of backlash. And this is something that, you know, I've been experiencing more and more these days with this like kind of idea of political correctness, which I was surprised would even hit this sort of subject material.
Yeah, right.
But that is something that when you talk about these things, more and more mainstream scholars, or even though this is work from a mainstream scholar, but if you talk about it in relation to this idea of, you know, an advanced civilization moving elsewhere, then it puts you in this kind of area of, you know, borderline white supremacy kind of thing, because blue eyes are sometimes associated with the white people and this sort of thing. And it's really unfortunate, but that is stopping a lot of people from doing this sort of research and connecting these dots for fear that they will be classified as, you know, a white supremacist or an Aryan, because it sort of has that, you know, that feel to it, if you will, that idea that, oh, the black-headed people with the brown eyes, they weren't good enough or smart enough. They had to have like a person from the north with blue eyes come down and help them out. And so it does sound pretty bad when you put it that way, but you know, it's important probably not to put it that way, but instead just cite the science and discuss these ideas and just stick to the science of it. But it's been very much discouraged now, even in mainstream, to do that. In fact, there was a recent gathering of archaeologists in, I believe it was Texas. I'll have to find the article again. I'll send it over to you to look at. It's wild. They had a conference to discuss what to do about fringe archaeologists, and they basically came to the conclusion that what they had to do was paint them out to be white supremacists, because this was, you know, the best way to get them canceled in the cancel culture that we have now, that they had dangerous ideas and this sort of thing. And so you'll see a lot of times the narrative with some of the online debunkers and bloggers and people like that who just don't like this kind of research. What they do now is they fall back on this idea that, oh, well, this is like hyper diffusionist, you know, racist kind of, you know, nonsense, and it's terrible and it's, you know, immoral. And anybody who supports even looking into this is just, you know, so that's what they've tried to do. But it was actually a concerted effort at a conference to try to put an end to this kind of, you know, they cited Ancient Aliens as one of the big problems, and television shows and popular culture. And so they wanted to kind of push back on it. And the way they chose to do so was to call out the, you know, I guess the lack of PC, or they tried to just throw it into that whole, you know, thing, that kind of culture war thing right now. So, yeah, and it was widely published, too. So that it's pretty disappointing. Yeah, they said it's dangerous and it needs to be stopped. And that's the spin. Because if you just start saying, oh, it's not helpful, or we don't like it, or it's stupid, or these people are kooks, or foil hats, or all the old school things you could say, that's not good enough. That just seems harmless. So they figure what they have to do is make it sound harmful so that we can really put a stop to it. It's a way to end free speech. And that's what they're trying to do. That's their newest thing, is to say, you know, anybody who speaks about these different ways of looking at the history of human migration or any of this, it's dangerous and we can't let them do it. They're Nazis. That's really what it is. It's just like, oh, okay.
Yeah, well, heaven forbid we might uncover something else. Maybe we find a real answer, but does that mean that that's it? And here's the deal. So what if we find the genealogical lineage? Does that mean that then those are only the superior beings? We've all been so watered down by now.
Exactly.
It doesn't matter, but boy, wouldn't it be great to know? Listen, for years, 52 years, I lived without knowing who my biological father was. And was I missing anything? Did it keep me from having my own family or career? No. But it was this void inside of wanting to know where I came from, what, you know, looking in the mirror, what aspects of me were part of him. Now that that answer has been found, thanks to DNA and thanks to these kind of testing, I know who my biological father is. It's filled a void for me. Doing that and going through and getting the answers that we need is only going to help strengthen us and perhaps even help us understand how we evolved, why we evolved, and maybe there are some triggers we can learn that would be able to help us in our current physical states to re-engage aspects of what we once were.
I couldn't agree more. I think that's spot on. And I mean, even if...
Did you hear that, Tim? I'm spot on. A doctor said,
wow.
I made a good point and I'm spot on. I Jeez. Can call the show. Let's just end it now. Why go further?
I guess.
Wow. All right. No, thank you. I appreciate that. It's not.
No, no. You always make good points, though. And that is not even a joke. That is, you know, but that I'm not surprised. I mean, most people who are interested in alternative ideas, you know, just have a broader range of thought processes, in my opinion.
Tim's rolling his eyes so hard that the people within a mile radius.
I was going to say,
wonder what that shaking noise is.
I was going to say, Doctor, let's not overinflate the old ego here. We only have so much time in the show. Yeah.
Why'd you say old? Just because I'm 52? Come on.
Yeah, well.
Agent bastards. See what I got to work with, Doctor? This is unbelievable.
You could just tell him to go back in his hole.
That's right. Yeah. We see that both of us, I've got brown eyes and no hair. And no, Tim's got kind of hazily eyes, no hair. We don't even know which tribe we're originally from now.
So instead of the black-headed ones, you could be the bald-headed ones.
Yes. Oh, well, as we are often known. So you're breaking down this information and re-examining all of this. What, if anything, was still kind of a surprise to you information-wise that existed out there?
You know, I think just the idea that the sage thing really got to me, because the more and more I kept looking at how the Anunnaki are just more than likely human beings. It's not to disregard the magnificent story or what they did or whatnot, but this notion of these seven sages really just stuck with me. And the more I read about that, the more I thought, how strange is it that the similarities between those particular beings and other beings from other religious ideas all over the world at different points. And so, you know, and some of the things that they shared in common. So this idea that you could channel them through sort of meditation or prayer or hymns or deep, deep kind of meditation specifically, but also through taking psychedelic drugs, that sort of thing. And that what they would have are very similar descriptions of how these things looked, what they did, and what their maybe motive was. They would all describe this, you know, coming in contact with these sages and having them give them the knowledge of high technology. And then they would come out of that sort of like a shaman experience. It was very much similar to what someone could have going into this, you know, other world of the shamans. And it was something that was shared in that culture and other cultures. I mean, it's, and I saw it creep up from, I mean, even modern culture. So the idea of people, you know, now doing, you know, like psychonauts and people who are experimenting with DMT or psilocybin, and they're seeing what they call clockwork elves or sometimes machine elves, and having very similar experiences too, with them giving them this technology and, you know, all of this. And so I just think that it fits some sort of weird pattern that you could see from almost the very beginning to even now. So you see that, you know, people will still contact, or at least believe that they're in contact with similar, strange, semi-biological entities from a different dimension. And so, you know, now, like I said, they could be the machine elves, or, you know, they could be considered elves and fairies, or, you know, but they were at the time called the Seven Sages, or Apkula, or Apakulu, and the archons of the Gnostics were a very similar thing. The serpent gods of the Far East and Central America, the Titans of the Greeks, which, you know, was different than their regular gods, and even the Snake Brothers of the Hopi, and, you know, the Elohim. You have all of these same kinds of almost primordial beings that had, when you just strip it down to its base sort of nature or behavior, very similar things. And I think that's something that, you know, was my takeaway from this, that, you know, maybe because my earlier book was Evil Archaeology and I was looking more into that spiritual, or, you know, the entity, you know, version of things, it just sort of stuck with me. And I thought, I wonder if there's more to this. And so, you know, I did look into it, added a little more to the book, but it's, I think it's something that I want to explore even further. Right now I'm writing a follow-up to Evil Archaeology, which is going to be the polar opposite, because I felt I needed a chaser after that one. It's about angels and miracles and that sort of thing, but not in just necessarily the whole, like, oh, isn't this great, you know, highway to heaven kind of, you know, touched by an angel thing, but more so the, you know, connection between Sumerian and, you know, ancient mythologies and their idea of angels and the origin of angels. And so the more I do those types of, you know, that type of research, the more I come across this reference to these sort of almost interdimensional beings that were just very similar across all these different cultures. And that's sticking out to me as something that, you know, I didn't expect, and it's something that I'm probably going to spend a lot more time researching. I think that's probably the biggest takeaway.
That any of these discoveries would truly upset the balance of religious nature, or do you think that it would maybe end up bolstering it and strengthening those concepts?
You know, I think for some it might actually bolster them, but I think that in terms of a orthodox point of view, I think no, because there's so many people that, you know, it's like that old saying of, if you're holding on to something so tightly with both fists, you're not going to be able to reach out and grab something else. So you're just clinging to those old ways of thinking. And so you're not going to be able to, you know, have anything new.
Mainstream religions would want a discovery like this, right? We're going to cling to a cloth with an image of a man on it, hoping that this is some kind of radiation burst of Christ at the time of his passing. We'll accept that as a possibility, or an oil stain on a wall that's in the shape of Mother Mary, and people will show up in flocks. But if we were able to actually prove that some of these ancient beings, the Anunnaki, the Elohim, the characters that were fleshed out in the Bible, that's considered, and not just the Bible, there's different versions, right? The Kabbalah, I'm trying to remember, in the Jewish religion, that their Bible is referred to as what?
We have the Talmud,
So if we're able to actually concretely devise, hey, this is what was referred to. Look, this is exactly what this was, instead of speculative, just kind of, oh, well, it's in there, so we just believe it exists, or that it was a parable of a sort. Instead, we're finding true documented cases of these beings, or perhaps what the words are in the Bible and what they really meant in physical form. I like I said, I would think that would only help in the long run.
Well, if you were looking for it to help. And if you're wanting to be helpful, absolutely. But maybe it has to do more with control than help. So if you are the leader of a large religious organization or something like that, maybe you don't want your people knowing the truth. Maybe it would be better to have them believing in the old ways of doing things because, you know, it's the devil you know instead of the devil you don't. And so if everybody, you know, had this knowledge that, say, for instance, you know, what they're trying to do and, you know, in Silicon Valley and these different areas, trying to get in touch with these beings now, you know, you've had that with shamans or even people who channel what they think are aliens, or people who try to speak to angels or any of these things. What if the truth was that we could, as individuals, without having to rely on a series of, you know, rituals and dogmas from an organized religion, what if we could channel something or access that information or pierce the veil all by ourselves? And then what? Maybe they would be useless. And I'm not even saying it's a good thing, because from my research, you probably shouldn't be doing any of that sort of thing since it is so unknown. And I think one of the best quotes on that is Carl Jung, where he warns, be careful of unearned wisdom. You know, that's, you don't want to take shortcuts to earning your wisdom. And so, you know, it's something to probably not play around with. But I mean, for the sake of argument, if you think about it, it could have a lot of implications for an organized system that might have an interest in maintaining its authority and control over its people, especially if they themselves don't even know what's going on, but they are also trying to research that behind closed doors to figure it out. I don't know. I think maybe if they wanted to be helpful, that would be one thing, but do they want to be helpful might be the question.
Fascinating stuff. The book is out, for those of you that are fans as well, Eric Von Daniken, his quote, "The Anunnaki Connection is the best compendium for extraterrestrial visits in years." That's got to be a nice little blurb to get from Daniken, right, to believe that there is some connection and connective tissue here to that. Now, you said that in some instances you feel that these are just titles bestowed upon humanity. What if you could pin it to the top two or three items that really prove that we have had extraterrestrial help or interdimensional something, you know, I don't know what the right politically correct term would be, but it's an outside influence aside from the humans and humanity that was birthed on this planet, something else. What would you point those out to be?
Well, you know, I think an easy one would be saying these great monuments or buildings, but I don't believe that that's the case, because I do believe that ancient people are very, very capable of physically building things and, you know, that. So if I had to pick something that would be completely like strange, it would be probably language, like a really organized language and writing and mathematics and how those things are related. And so math, language, music, but the mastery of those things all put together. So I think maybe more generally, it would be the proof of abstract, highly intellectual and teachable skills. So not inventions made of stone or even, you know, minor sort of discoveries or methods of doing things, but specifically things that we would consider intellectual, abstract, but teachable. I think that's kind of where it all fits together. Something happened. Something happened to make what scholars call the Sumerians being unusually creative intellectually. And so, I mean, that I think that's kind of the thing. So yes, the building's amazing. Everything's amazing. You can't really, you know, say that it's just not awe-inspiring to see how big these things can be and, you know, whatever. But ancient people, in my view, could do amazing things. But still leaves it open to how did we make that leap from, you know, daily survival and, you know, a loose culture to highly creative, intellectual, abstract thought that could be, you know, just derivative, and then taught and then expanded just this whole new way of being. I think that's the mystery to me.
Well, I wish you a lot of luck with the book. I know you had some health issues a while back dealing with this virus and what's going on. We're so glad that you're able to be a part of our show and glad that you've rebounded from that as well. So thank you for being here and reexamining some of these concepts and allowing and what I do like about your books as well is they're not heady. They're not overblown, overtalked. This is something that's very easy to read, very easy to understand, and you make it accessible to the masses as opposed to feeling like they're being talked over. So thank you so much for doing that and always making it about exploration. And personally, we love that here on Darkness Radio.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for those kind words. And thank you, for all the thoughts and prayers, too. I believe that's how I got through everything. And thank you again for having me on. I really appreciate it.
The Anunnaki Connection, Sumerian Gods, Alien DNA, and the Fate of Humanity. That is out and available. We have a link to the book on the site and Dr. Lynn's website, so you can find more information. Stay safe, folks. We'll be back again with you Tuesday with more of the best in True Crime Talk Radio. True Crime Tuesdays every Tuesday. And next weekend with more of the best in Paranormal Talk Radio. I'm Dave Schrader. That's Tim Dennis. And this is Darkness Radio.